Noah, Genesis 6 through 9. Charles McGrath. I was raised a Catholic, and Catholics in those days weren't really Bible people. For all I know, they still aren't. Bible reading, I understood then, was something that Protestants went in for, and look where it got them. We had missals and faithfully took them to Mass. Fancy little books with leatherette covers, gilt-edged pages, a little red tassel for keeping your place, and even some text printed in red, the rubrics. But if there was a Bible in the house, I don't remember ever seeing it. Selections from the New Testament, the Gospels, and the Epistles were read aloud in church every Sunday, but the Old Testament we mostly knew from hearsay. Moses and the tablets, Daniel in the den, Joseph in his coat, Solomon proposing to hack the baby in two. These were familiar stories, like folk tales almost, but not text to be pored over. We grew up with the sense that the Bible was such a dense and forbidding book that amateurs weren't entirely to be trusted with it. I first heard the story of Noah from my father, who was mildly obsessed with it. I'm not sure why, exactly. He loved boats and was unhappy in his work, beset by money problems. So perhaps the notion of 40 days afloat appealed to him, secure and self-sufficient in a brand-new wooden vessel and not one made of fiberglass, which my father detested, followed by a complete reboot in which you could start your life all over again. My father was not a literalist exactly, but a man of very practical imagination, and many of the other details in the story bothered him. How could Noah build such an ark with just his three sons? Without power tools, it would have taken them decades. How did they herd all those animals? And once the creatures were all on board, what prevented them from eating each other? What did Noah and the crew do about the prodigious amounts of manure that would have piled up? This one bothered me, too, until I saw the recent Darren Aronofsky movie, Noah, in which the animals are put to sleep after a few whiffs of some very righteous dope that Noah burns in his censer. That seems as good a solution as any. The one detail my father never questioned, and the one that seemed to appeal to him the most, was God's placing the rainbow in the sky as a promise that he wouldn't do this kind of thing again. If we were driving in the car and happened to see a rainbow, he never failed to bring this up. God will never again destroy the world by flood, my father would explain, though he once suggested that didn't necessarily mean God wouldn't let a nuclear war happen. I didn't begin to read the Bible on my own until I got to college, began studying 17th century English literature, and fell in love with the King James Version. Not the most accurate of translations, perhaps, but still a grand monument of English prose. I hadn't read the Noah story in years, but went back not long ago after watching the Aronofsky movie. Who were those creatures that looked like transformers made out of boulders? I wondered. How had I missed them? Because they're not there, it turns out. What mostly struck me this time was the sublime bleakness of the poetry. Here, for example, is a description of the flood. And the waters prevailed exceedingly upon the earth, and all the high hills that were under the whole heaven were covered. 15 cubits upward did the waters prevail, and the mountains were covered, and all the flesh died that moved upon the earth, both of fowl and of cattle, and of beast, and of every creeping thing that creepeth, and every man. All in whose nostrils was the breath of life, of all that was in the dry land, died. The repeated H sound in that first verse, the doubling of creeping and creepeth, that wonderful phrase, all in whose nostrils was the breath of life, the way the syntax holds off that emphatic died until the very end, this is a verse that really enjoys the destruction it's talking about, and prolongs it even just to enhance.